Hi everyone, this is PCPCC. How does this sound?
There, much better.
Oh, okay, good.
Great.
Well, thank you everyone for joining our call today. We have a great lineup of presenters to talk about the new parity regulations that came out last week or a couple weeks ago. So this is Tara Hacker with the PCPCC. I just wanted to confirm that we have the speakers on the line. So, Colleen, I know you're on the line. Is Diane on the line?
Yes, I am.
Great. And Tamar?
Yes, I'm here.
Perfect. And Sandra?
I'm here as well.
Wonderful. So, folks, I just want to remind everyone, with this new, the new phone lines, or I guess our old lines, we tried out a different phone lines that didn't work for us, so we're going back to our old ones. It's *6 to mute yourself and *6 again to unmute your line. So if you can just do us a favor, and if you're not speaking, go and put yourself on mute. If we have to mute you, you'll have to call back in or wait until we unmute you. The other thing I want to talk about is we have a few events going on with the PCPCC. We have a national briefing tomorrow featuring Matt Longjohn of the YMCA. He'll be giving a talk on chronic disease prevention in the medical neighborhood and their efforts to integrate community health workers. We also have put together, we're in partnership with the American Cancer Society, a three-part series webinar on cancer care and how the medical home team can partner with the oncology teams to really provide, coordinated team-based care for patients going through cancer and of course, their caregivers. So that information you'll find at the bottom of the agenda. A few other links to some recent articles as well. Dr. Jürgen Unitzer from the University of Washington came out with an article in Psychiatric News. I want to refer you to that one, and then a few other ones. So with no further ado, I just want to turn it over to Colleen, who's going to lead us off in the presentation on the parity. Colleen, go ahead. Well, Colleen, we can't hear you. Oh, we lost Colleen. Colleen, if you had your phone on mute, if you dial *6, it will also unmute your line.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, now yes. We can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. And so the conference host muted the conference. So I don't know if everybody else is in the same spot. So anyway, thank you for having me, and I thought what I would do, since I'm first, and I understand there's varying levels of knowledge about the Mental Health Parity Act on the line, just give sort of a broad overview of what it does and does not do, and what we think the problems remaining are, and then, just a couple of words about how I think it impacts primary care. So MAPIA was passed in 2008, and it's basically an anti-discrimination statute that prohibits discrimination in benefits for health plans that offer both mental health care and medical surgical benefits. It does not require health plans to offer mental health coverage, but the Affordable Care Act does make mental health coverage an essential health benefit, which means that under the Affordable Care Act, the states are going to determine which mental health disorders are going to be covered and which are not under health plans. Why is it important? It's important because it compares financial limitations, such as copays and deductibles, quantitative limitations, such as the number of visits or hospital days, and most importantly, I think, non-quantitative treatment limitations, which are things like prior authorization, provider reimbursement rates, and medical management standards. On the mental health side, to the same things on the medical surgical side of the plan, and says that you have to treat them in an equivalent manner. Where mental health is covered, basically, it needs to be no better or no worse than coverage for any other illness. So it doesn't provide certain coverage, but it does require the coverages to be similar. In 2010, there were interim rules that were passed explaining some of the finer portions of the Mental Health Parity Act and setting out certain standards that would judge whether a plan was in compliance with the non-quantitative treatment limitations and the quantitative treatment limitations rules. The rules were basically pretty good, but the insurance community tended to ignore them. We know we had raised the mental health parity issue and helped patients raise that issue on numerous appeals that were filed, and in those cases, the insurance companies basically didn't even answer those issues. And I think that the Department of Labor, which enforces mental health parity, was of the view that it was sort of an experimental period where they were going to help the plans to understand what it meant rather than enforce the rules as written. On November 8th, we had some final rules, which are quite dense, and we're still studying them. But they did, from our view right now, they tended to clarify some of the issues that providers and patients and health plans were disputing during the time frame of the interim rules to the 3.5 years it took to get a final rule. So the best thing that happened is that the final rule clarified that residential treatment cannot be excluded for mental health substance use disorder patients if it's not excluded for medical surgical patients. And that, I think, has great weight in the substance use disorder community and for eating disorders. It sounds, at least, like enforcement may now not be experimental, but that the Department of Labor is planning on enforcing the rule. Some of the bigger problems we see are that Medicaid is not addressed. It's not included in mental health parity, and it's kind of unclear right now what that means and how far that goes, and the agencies have promised further FAQs and guidance on that issue. The other issue that we see that is enforcement is left largely to the states. And in our experience in trying to enforce the interim regulations, most of the state insurance commissioners that we spoke to had never heard of the Mental Health Parity Act, and they had no idea that they were supposed to be enforcing it. So there's a lot of education that probably needs to be done on that angle. So how does it impact primary care? A couple of ways come to mind. One would be that to the extent there are screening guidelines by the health plan for, you know, example, diabetes, tuberculosis, other chronic illnesses, they may also require mental health screenings now under the Parity Act. Their tools need to be developed for those. Mental health screening tools are not that far along, and not all diseases are not necessarily, they don't necessarily come with a tool to help with the screening. The second way is through quality and outcome-based compensation, given the relationship between mental health issues and physical health issues. Both need to be treated in order to show quality outcomes. So it will require more integrated care, which is now permissible under MAPIA, because if the health plan under the ACA has to provide mental health care and it has to be equivalent to the care provided for medical surgical claims, the patients should be able to access care because discrimination should be prohibited. It does call for provision. It does suggest that there's going to be a greater need for integration between mental health care and primary care. And I think how to do that best, and from our perspective, how to integrate psychiatry into that model is, something that needs to be explored and that we have to work together on. The last point I would raise is that there is now a dearth of data on access issues with respect to network adequacy for mental health providers. And I think that there is a great need to look at whether there are avenues for referral within networks that primary care providers have to mental health providers and whether they're actually available in those networks. And so that's something that we probably would like to be talking to this group about to see if we can come up with some data on that. And with that, I will turn it over to somebody else.
Thanks so much, Colleen. Deborah, you want to go ahead?
Diane, sorry.
Sure, happy to. First of all, thank you, Colleen. That was an excellent overview of the final regulation. I want to just draw people's attention to a few of the specifics to kind of help illustrate what, to those of us in the mental health community, is so important about the final rule and the way that it differs from the interim final. For the most part, mental health parity really was already being implemented through the interim final, but we are actually happy to see this final rule established because of a few areas that had been raised that we felt had not been adequately addressed. In particular, Colleen already mentioned one of them, which is they clarified that the parity requirements do extend to intermediate levels of care. And I think that had been somewhat of a gray area for some providers, facilities, plans, and issuers before, in that it perhaps did not fit quite as neatly with the six different classifications that had been used. But the rule is very clear that essentially you use the same process and standards that you do for medical surge when looking at mental health and substance use disorders. And I think that is really one of the overlying contexts that goes with this final rule, which is that there are many aspects of it that, especially in regard to the non-qualitative treatment limitations, are simply not so black and white. And so you may have situations where the results in terms of how benefits are provided may not be entirely equal between the two sides, but what the departments would be looking very closely at would be essentially what was the process, what was the standard, what was the benefit design that you used to get there. And they're making it very clear that those processes and standards for mental health and substance use disorders cannot be more stringently applied than they would be for medical surgical. Another piece that's very important for people is that they established that the criteria for medical necessity documentation has to be the same as it is for medical surgical. And for many people in the past, this has been a bit of a struggle. Sometimes when people were appealing claims, trying to get additional information on why a claim was denied, for example, they weren't often given as much documentation as they need. So again, this rule makes it very clear that mental health and substance use disorders have to be treated the same as medical surgical in regards to that type of information. And that, again, includes the process and any evidentiary standards and factors that are used to make those types of determinations. I want to echo what Colleen said about there being more illustration in the final rule. Again, definitely with regard to the non-qualitative treatment limitations, there are several additional examples, particularly in areas dealing with things like network tier designs, standards for providers who are being admitted to participate in a network, and methods for determining usual, customary, and reasonable charges. I also want to draw attention to the fact that the departments have stated that they may provide additional guidance if questions persist with respect to provider reimbursement rates. So something for people to keep in mind if this is an issue for them, to make sure that you submit that to a comment to the departments. And that's it for my portion.
Hi, can you hear me? This is Tamar.
Yep, we can hear you.
Thanks so much. This is Tamar Magaracara with the American Academy of Pediatrics. I think we would concur with many of the statements made by the previous speakers, and I'm going to attempt to not duplicate what they have already well covered. But I just wanted to say that we're very excited to see the final rule come out, and it did provide a lot of clarity in areas I think we were hoping to see. The examples and illustrations, particularly on quantitative treatment limitations, I think will be very instructive as we continue to evaluate the impact when the final rule does take effect. And I should mention that it the final rule does take effect for plan years on July 1, 2019. 2014, which in effect will largely mean an effective date of 2015, the beginning of 2015 for health plans. We, as was noted earlier, the final rule does not address Medicaid managed care, the Medicaid alternative benchmark plans, aka the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, or CHIP. And so that's something we're keeping a very close eye on and are very concerned about. The operative document right now is a state health official letter that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services put out in January of this year. And I think there's some areas that we're keeping a very close eye on, particularly as it applies to Medicaid managed care. More than half of the states are delivering Medicaid through a managed care organization, and even a greater number utilizing Medicaid behavioral health managed care. So we're very, you know, going to be very interested to see what kind of clarification comes out from CMS. The final rule does indicate that guidance will be forthcoming. We hope that it will largely mirror some of the clarifications, particularly on the non-quantitative treatment limitations in the final rule, and that some greater clarity in terms of enforcement will be forthcoming. For the Academy and pediatricians in primary care, we're very much interested in looking at how the final rule will help address many of the administrative and financial barriers that exist to integration of mental health in primary care settings. We have a number of things we've said over the years about the importance of that, including a joint paper that we published with the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry that really highlights many of the barriers that exist to primary care being able to deliver mental health services. And we hope that, particularly with the non-quantitative treatment limitation and illustrations, particularly on network adequacy and the payment rates and provider payment rates being used very clearly not allowed to be used as a means of discriminating against mental health services, I think will be of great interest and something we follow from the primary care side. We're also looking at the interplay between the final rule and the coverage of Bright Futures preventive services with no copays for new plans sold in marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act, as well as non-grandfathered plans. Involves a number of screening and preventive services, including mental and behavioral health services for children. And then the interplay between the final rule and the Medicaid payment increase that's currently the law and being implemented in states to varying degrees, but is the law currently, and sort of the interplay between that and the codes covered for that payment increase and the network adequacy and payment rate requirements under parity for 2015. I think with that, I will turn it over to the next speaker.
Thanks so much, Tamar.
Yeah.
Sandra?
Okay, good. Thank you very much for calling.
Oh, Sandra, are you on the line? Oh, we can't
hear
you, Sandra. Oh, yep.
There you go.
We hear you now.
Well, geez, I should have known better than to go last because everyone does just such an amazing job of capturing all the issues that I was going to mention. So I think I'm just going to have to go and wing it and see if I can offer anything to flesh out some of the statements I think that were made by the first speaker about integrated care models, workforce issues. You know, what can we do that thinking about how parity is going to change the landscape of folks who are accessing care and how we're going to try to address that. And I think I'll just say a couple things and then open up for questions because it sounds like there's a ton of information to share. First of all, I hope that folks are familiar with the integrated care models that are coming online and that are in experimental phases. I'm sure you all are very well aware of the health homes models and demonstrations and our integrated primary care, integrating primary care into the behavioral health setting. And in many of the second round applications for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation
grants, which is $1 billion this year, are actually taking a closer look at integrated models. One example I can highlight now is called the Come Home model. This is actually based on oncology care, so it's not in a primary care setting, but they are experimenting with multiple ways to offer behavioral health services in a truly simultaneous integrated manner in their program through offering social work services immediately on site, referral mechanisms, and so on. And so there are experimental programs going on right now, and I encourage folks to try to stay abreast of what those are in your particular state and how to try to access some of those experimental opportunities through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And I think the first speaker also highlighted where we are in quality and that there's a lot of work to be done there, you know, as we're thinking about value-based purchasing and reimbursement structures that really focus on outcomes and quality. There's a ton to be done in mental health. There are also a number of great measures out there. So part of it is really just bringing experts together in conversations like this so that they can share what already exists and what kind of easy training tools there are to bring some of those quality measures online in folks' offices so that they feel comfortable with that. And then workforce issues, of course, where as much as primary care is in a shortage position, you all know well that mental health providers and allied mental health providers, psychiatrists, psychologists, you name it, we're in desperate need of a pretty strong workforce there. And of course, as access ramps up, we need to think strongly about that and building that workforce. And some of those efforts have been stalled with a lot of the political gridlock here in D.C., which I'm sure nobody here is surprised to hear about. But there are a number of provisions, for example, in health reform that that would actually bolster the workforce in mental health and pediatric specialty services, in primary care, in allied mental health professional services that we just aren't able to get up and running and funded right now. So I'll just stop there because I feel like I can't add anything to what was said before, and I'm happy to and help with any questions on my end.
Thank you, everyone, for providing us those summaries. I want to open it up to the line again to the folks on the phone. You can press *6 to unmute yourself, and we'll start unmuting your lines manually as well to any of those that we muted due to background noise. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. How do you see this impacting access for behavioral health across our communities?
Who wants to jump on that one?
I can take a stab at that. This is Colleen. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yep, go ahead, Colleen.
Okay. So I think the access issue is going to be initially exacerbated as more and more people have access to more and more people realize that they have coverage for their behavioral health needs. One of the issues for access to care, I think particularly for behavioral health, are provider reimbursement rates. Providers are traditionally paid significantly below what non-mental health physicians and other service providers are paid, and that causes them to decline participation in networks. And so if the final rule is enforced, because the final rule does provide a pretty explicit provision for provider reimbursement rates, basically saying that whatever methodology you use to come up with the rates on the medical surgical side, you have to use a similar methodology and you can't apply the factors more stringently to mental health. That should provide a rise in provider reimbursement rates and should encourage people to participate in the network. I don't think that's going to happen voluntarily. I think it's going to have to be enforced. And so I don't see that happening you know, in the very near future, perhaps 2 years down the road if a lawsuit is successful or if the federal government decides to actually enforce those issues or the states do?
Well, this is one comment.
Howard King, okay. Speaking from Boston. May I go ahead with a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
When we use parity, it means different things to different primary care people. Oftentimes, I find that physicians just brush aside the role of time when we're doing an assessment. In short, a 15-minute visit to assess a family or a person or a patient is different from taking, say, 45 minutes. So that we need to be at least open-minded about the role of time in doing a parity examination. Secondly, we need to be somewhat self-aware about how our own issues may get in the way of doing an assessment. And if we're not mindful of our own difficulties or obstacles, that may also impair the effectiveness of implementation of parity. So I'd be just curious how the group of you feel about the definition of parity when the rubber hits the road.
Diane, you want to take a first stab at that one?
That's a tough one, and maybe part of it is the difference in the way that mental health professionals may view what we consider parity versus what you may have in mind or other types of healthcare professionals may have in mind. You raise an important issue about time. I guess we see this as they've all been building blocks. Getting the law was the first huge building block. Having the interim final rule, having the first set of rules was a building block. The interim final rules was a building block. And even this, considered the final rule, is not the exact end of it. As the departments have indicated, they may issue more guidance in other areas that will continue to flesh some of this out. We also have kind of an interesting dynamic going on because there's what we have under mental health parity, and then there's also what's going to be going on under the Affordable Care Act and the essential health benefits, which are also going to be very advantageous, we certainly hope, to mental health benefits for a number of different plans that previously may not have been impacted. So there's a number of different changes going on right now, and I think Colleen mentioned there's definitely still going to be somewhat of a transition period, even with the additional illustrations that we have in this final rule, but we certainly hope that when it all comes to fruition, that we get closer and closer to a situation where there really is not a distinction between the mind and body health of the patient.
This is Dr. Wetteraw interrupting from ACM.
Hello.
Hi, Norm Wetteraw on the call. I think to add to this, two things. One, I don't know if anyone on our call in this group is involved in the payment group that's looking at payment. I'm not, but I think they needs to be. Also, ASAM has come out with the American Society of Addiction Medicine replacement criteria, brand new edition, which is very explicit and clearly indicates what kind of treatment at what level and what it should consist of, and then there's an evaluation process. I'll be honest, it's the kind of thing you look at and you think, oh, no. But it is the basis. I had some contribution to it. It's the basis for going forward, you know, what level of treatment, what does it need to consist of? It doesn't give a price, but it's the basis for negotiation in terms of what is offered, what is needed, and then an evaluation process in terms of quality. So I don't know whether mental health is doing that, and when you're talking about it, is it the Psychiatric Association, is it the Psychological Association, is it the Social Workers Association, but trying to look at that, because, you know, you do want to make sure that the you're not going to be able to prescribe an hour of counseling just and get paid the same as something else for, you know, whatever. This can be a real long process, and I don't know whether anybody in this group whether we should have representation on the group that develops payment reform. But
hello, this is Sandra. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, Sandra,
yes.
We can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I keep trying to talk, and sometimes I can't get through. I'm going to speak to you now as a psychologist, which is actually my training, and tell you a couple of things. I mean, you make a really good point, and people are actually looking at payment reforms and trying to understand how all this fits together. But it sounds like there are a couple more basic questions, and one is, you know, how does this impact you all in your practice on a daily basis? What are the time commitments? What do you need to know? What are the levels of treatment that are required, and how do you make those determinations and so on? So I just want to take 1 second to talk about that. And all of the psychiatric association, psychological association, social workers, everybody has developed some tools, some best practices, and there are some very, very brief screening tools that are well validated that can be used, for example, for teen depression. Of course, that's one of the recommended preventative services and so on that could be administered in a primary care setting. And this is where the creativity comes in, is that when you think about integrating care, you know, who do you have on staff? Who's part of your team? And how, at what point do you make that handoff that saves you time, that is an efficient and a cost-effective manner to do this, but at the same time engages a person who has the right level of training to take this over. So you don't always have to think about, you know, what are my family dynamics and how's this entering the picture. You can do a brief minute or two screen, some very brief motivational interviewing, and hand someone off to someone on your team for further coordination. So I just wanted to point those things out, and I think it would be great if you all invited folks who are experts in this from the mental health side onto one of your calls.
Well, this is Howard King again. I think we need to avoid trying to divide groups into pediatricians versus psychiatrists. If people are thoughtful and good listeners, they may decide at the moment that this particular child or family needs a half hour, 45 minutes, and this idea of handing it off because it's more than 10 to 15 minutes personally seems inappropriate to me. And if you have the ability and are willing to sacrifice spending that time, you should be encouraged to do it and not say, well, you're a 10-minute doctor and that's all you're going to spend.
Tamara, this is Amy. I don't mean to necessarily call you out, but I am. I think, you brought up Bright Futures, and Bright Futures is a really good model when we're talking about this real integration of looking at the whole patient, looking at the whole child and the family in the context of their environment. And Bright Futures is one place where, you know, there's been some criticism as it relates to, oh, you're adding more onto this visit. I've got, you know, limited amount of time. But as we're talking about different payment models and opportunities within the patient-centered medical home to really build out the team and do is kind of how he's talking about, you know, having different members of the team being able to jump in at different points in time depending on the needs of the family, but still really addressing all of those clinical guidelines and looking at quality overall. How are the pediatricians kind of viewing this?
No, I think it's a great great point that you make, and I think there's a lot of opportunities and reasons to be optimistic, both through the final rule, but also I think broadly speaking through coverage of Bright Futures and the Medicaid payment increase that is, you know, is paying out in states, and where our members are reporting receiving payment. It's not uniform, and it's definitely been a little bumpy ride, but I think it also, you know, it's important. Pediatricians are very used to a team-based care model. It's an ideal setting, and we've certainly written a bit about this, about how you can do this team-based care model and integration in the primary care setting. And there are a number of things that where pediatricians are well-positioned to be doing screening and initial treatment. But I think, you know, there are certain workforce issues that are persistent throughout the country, and there's some interesting, exciting models going on in Massachusetts through the Child Psychiatry Access Program and many other replications of that throughout the country that are, you know, reasons to be optimistic. I think the tie-in with parity and the final rule is, I think, you know, in terms of addressing some of the payment barriers where, you know, we certainly hear from our members that there is does not exist consistently diagnostic and procedural parity at the primary care level for numerous mental health conditions, and or the issue of, well, you know, we know there's issues going on with this child or adolescent, but doesn't rise to the level of a, you know, a DSM-5, for instance, diagnosis. And so how do you set up a payment model that accounts for that? Oh, by the way, while we're doing all these umpteen, you know, other things that we need to be doing in a well child visit, for instance. So I think there's reason to be hopeful, but I think it's going to take some time to see how this plays out. And certainly the Medicaid, I don't mean to go back to this again, but the Medicaid managed care component of this is really going to be key, because just given how many children in this country are covered under in a state receiving Medicaid through managed care organizations. So I think there's sort of a piece of this that's sort of missing still, and we'll need a lot of oversight, I think, based on the experience that we hear from a lot of our members in states that are in managed care organizations. I don't know if that answers the question, but...
I would like to ask a related question.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
How do you feel this will impact the reimbursement for adult primary care physicians who are historically paid less than their full amount of reimbursement for visits that contain a primary diagnosis that's mental health, such as depression? So if a patient comes in and presents with no other issues, physician diagnosis depression, sends the bill accordingly, you know, X dollars normal charge, that physician will get reimbursed less because that primary diagnosis was mental health related. Will this affect that in some way?
Well, why should it be paid less?
It just has been historically. So all primary care physicians that I've worked with, and I do a lot of primary care, I'm a non-clinician, are typically reimbursed less by Medicare and other payers. So, for example, a mid-level 99213 visit that goes out with a diagnosis of only depression is paid less than they would normally be paid if that patient had come in for chronic heart failure or something, congestive heart failure.
Well, may I ask, why isn't this just time-based?
For that, and the physician is paid less if they submit a mental health diagnosis as the primary diagnosis.
Then parity doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't. But I don't know. I haven't heard that discussed at all. That goes to the reimbursement discussion that was going on previously, which seemed to be geared more towards the behavioral health parity issue, where a lot of behavioral health providers are non-par in networks because they're not paid sufficiently. This is a slightly different twist of that.
I actually have a question. This is Colleen from the APA. I don't think we've heard that before. What we have heard, particularly after the change in the CPT codes, to have psychiatrists bill the same E&M codes as primary care physicians, we've always heard that the behavioral health side just has a fee that's less for the same code than a primary care doctor. And so this is the first time I'm actually hearing what you're saying, because at least from the insurance companies and the fee schedules that we've seen, it's based on the provider's expertise as opposed to the diagnosis.
No, so we do the same thing. We establish a charge master for each level of service, whatever it might be, and it's consistent across all services. The payer receives that bill or the claim, and says, okay, this is the normal reimbursement schedule we've agreed to. This is the contract. We're going to knock 15% off that because that doctor submitted for a depression diagnosis. So they take the normal, we use our normal charge master. Attached to that is a normal expectation of reimbursement, which is reduced if the diagnosis is mental health. And so historically, everyone's been advised when you see the patient, they come in for fatigue and lethargy and other types of things, see if you can attribute it, in addition to a mental health diagnosis, to something physical so that you can get paid your normal amount.
I would think that that is just a pretty clear violation of parity.
That's what I think. I just haven't heard it discussed, but then the final regs are relatively new, so it may not have hit the streets yet.
And is this something that is it peculiar to one carrier, or do they all do the same thing?
No, it's pretty common. I don't believe it's changed as a result of anything I've heard of, but the conventional wisdom remained, don't use that diagnosis, you get paid less.
Interesting.
So it is a question. Whether some payers have responded now to the act and are changing it is a question, but that has historically been the case. Or sometimes it's as low as 50% of your normal reimbursement.
So, this is Sherry Grego at Blue Shield of California. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you.
So, and I can only speak for our plan, and I can tell you that that's not how our fee schedules work at all. Now, I think it is common in the industry where non-MDs, so we're not talking, especially with the new psych CPT code that came out in 2013, where psychiatrists are being paid based on an E&M code, just like MedSurg, and there's the add-on codes. So I think that's really helped with parity amongst MDs, you know, psychiatry and others, although we have that before anyway, but I think that does help standardize it. I think what you see is in the MFTs and LCSWs and PhDs, you know, the non-MDs, you do see industry-wide proprietary fee schedules that are unique to each level of licensure, and I think that's where a lot of the industry, at least in California, the complaints come, that those fees tend to be lower than MD fees, not unlike in MedSurg in some cases. Of course, we have podiatry and ophthalmology and other kinds of allies being paid a different schedule perhaps than an MD. So I don't think, you know, I think that those kinds of fee schedule differences, those are consistent and have always been consistent with the parity regulations because the methodologies for developing those fee schedules are consistent with the methodologies for developing a primary care fee schedule. That doesn't mean they're paid the same thing. So I do agree with an earlier comment somebody made that parity means lots of different things, not just in the delivery of care, but mental health services and diagnoses themselves are not exactly the same, as we all know, in terms of some of medical diagnoses. So even, you know, with coverage of residential treatment, I know for a lot of health plans, the challenge is, well, what benefit is that equal to? There's different kinds of residential treatments in medical that are very different than the type of residential treatment that you have in mental health. So I do think, you know, you can be compliant with the law, but the end result may not be what people are always expecting. And I do think that's going to be the challenge because I don't think, unless someone on the call can tell me differently, that the final regs are that prescriptive where they'll say this benefit has to equal that benefit under the MedSurg. You know, it's a different, and, you know, I think that's where we're going to see the challenges.
This is Diane, and that's an excellent point that you make, and I'll take it even a step farther. The final rule does go so far as to say that it does not mean there will always be equivalent results, and that a very important part of this is looking at the process, the standard, the way that the plan got to where it ended up, and it's looking to see that the process is equivalent or not significantly more burdensome on mental health, but it acknowledges that it may not mean the results are always the same.
Exactly. And I think that will be probably, you know, I would guess that will be the bigger disappointment amongst the mental health community because, you know, I'd like to think that we at Blue Shield of California have been parity way prior to the laws because it's the way we do business. But the end result doesn't mean that our mental health providers still feel underpaid and still feel somehow discriminated compared to their you know, medical physicians or others, but it's not because we're doing anything, you know, intentionally discriminating. You know, the market is different. The services are different, and it's not a one-to-one.
I think that the rule actually has some disclosure requirements that may help illuminate some of those issues, because I don't think that there's been a great deal of disagreement among the provider community that the issue is whether the processes and methodologies and things are the same or equivalent, but that the results can be different. But there hasn't been a great deal of transparency in what those processes are. And the final rule does actually address issues of transparency that may actually answer some of those questions.
This has been a really great conversation. Any other questions? And I think especially as it relates to various payment models, and it was brought up that there are some really exciting opportunities and innovative projects that are really starting to take a look at how we're integrating behavioral health into these alternative payment models as well. So, you know, certainly there's going to be a lot of challenges that we'll be facing as we're still mapping onto this fee-for-service model, but trying to move more towards a capitated bundled payment, more mixed payment methodologies, and ultimately more in shared savings and payment rewards for quality of care. And as we start to think about how behavioral health is brought into that whole mix too, is going to be really interesting. So one of the things that we really would like to do as part of this digital interest group is to share those models and let people know what's working, what's not working. And so please do share any of those that continue to come across your desk or that you're involved with, and we can invite speakers to this call and talk about the things that are working and some of the barriers and challenges we're still facing. We still do have about 10 minutes left on the call, so if you have some other questions, again, this has been, I think, a very eye-opening call for a lot of us as we think about how this is all going to play out. Are there some other thoughts or concerns that you have as this starts to move forward?
This is Howard King, the pediatrician, again. Is Tara there?
Hi, Howard. We're here.
Would you welcome comments offline to you or your office about how some of us are addressing this issue? Because oftentimes the whole area of stigma plays a role, not only in the part of patients, but on the part of physicians. Like they'd be more comfortable asking about stomach pain or headache than just frankly saying, how are you doing, shall we say, psychologically? And I see utilization or parity as providing an opportunity to call a spade, and to say, I'm willing to give you whatever time you need and document it so that people will increasingly feel comfortable integrating mental health as much as they do physical health into their primary care role. But we can't discuss that in an hour, but would you welcome notes to you reflecting how we're being successful doing that?
Oh, absolutely. Please do share any of those thoughts either over email or we can set up a call to talk more about it. So we want to hear about all those different models that are working in practice. So definitely, Howie, send those to us.
Thank you.
Any other questions for any of our panelists or anyone else on the call? I appreciate, Sherry, you jumping in and giving us a health plan perspective. Anybody else who's from a health plan or from another type of organization and how they're thinking through this? All right. Well, thank everyone who participated on the call today. We'll give you back a few extra minutes. Just to remind everyone that the next call for this special interest group is December 11th. Again, we've been working with a real strong, diverse, and committed group of leadership helping us to to identify some pertinent topics, and I think that this discussion hopefully was very helpful to all of you, as helpful as it was to us. But if any of you, even if you're not a part of that group, if you have other ideas for topics or speakers, either for this call or even for more general webinars or other types of presentations through the PCPCC, and again, as was brought up, we're always working and looking at how the payment model is working and supporting these integrated models, as we're really trying to promote and find ways to better integrate behavioral health into primary care, and so that these boundaries and barriers and separations between mental and behavioral health become less so in the primary care setting, for all those things that were brought up on this call is very important to us. So any ideas along those lines that you want us to continue to meld into our overall efforts on payment reform, we'd be more than happy to accept those from you as well. Any final comments or parting remarks from anyone?
I have one.
All right. Go ahead.
One of the things I take away that I think is useful in general is the idea that of building blocks, that getting the law is the first building block, then getting rules is a building block, then improving the rules is a building block, then you start having implementation issues, which run from stigma to how do I make this work, and what is parity anyway? And when people keep, in the end, the goal is not a distinction between the physical and mental health as a North Star, but then when you get into all, there's an evolution. And I think mapping out a lot of the in-practice things, like which models work, which ones feel good to people that seem to work well and patients respond to, there's a big cultural change. So I think tracking that is really going to be important, because it's like the social architecture is getting rearranged in primary care. And it's an interesting thing, but it's not so simple.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, we still have a lot of work that we need to do. And I think, too, as we explore more team-based care and thinking about the population that's being served and looking specifically at those needs, not just across diagnoses but also across culture, and other potential barriers as it relates to the stigma and receiving the most appropriate care at the right time and in lots of different ways. I think that there's a lot of opportunities, but certainly a lot of work to do moving forward. Well, I think those were great parting words. Thanks again, everyone who participated on the call, and we will talk to you all on December 11th.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.